Let's go together to the book of Job, Job chapter 28. Job 28. At this point in the story, we find Job again responding to his three tormentors. These friends who have come and sat with him for a time after he lost his health, he lost his family, lost his home, and all that he had owned, everything taken away from him just to see if he would fold. Satan wanted to try him and test him out. He came to God. By the way, he had the wrong question in mind. The question that he had in mind, we're still uncovering. The question at Satan's heart was, would Job serve you for nothing? Would he serve you for zero? If he got nothing out of it, would Job still serve you? Job asked a question in this book. Why me? Why? Why are bad things happening to me? I served you faithfully. Why would bad things happen to me? But God is asking another question, one that we are unpacking as we make our way through the book. A question that's been put into the light of three men who come and have, for all intents and purposes at this point in the book, are full on accusing Job of every wickedness you can imagine. Early on, about chapter 9, and on into chapter 20, this span of chapters is used for the accusers, his friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. It's used for these men to one at a time break Job down in his logic. Surely, Job, you've done something to anger God. And then in between each, you find Job responding, where he says, no, I haven't. I've not done this. Well, then it starts again in Job chapter 20, where now the three again come even more aggressively at Job. They come even more aggressively towards him, asking and demanding an answer, saying, what is it that you've done? What is it that has brought this on yourself? And Job is now in that second batch of responses. In Job chapter 28, we find Job respond again. In verse number 1, surely there is a vein for the silver, a place for gold where they find it. Iron is taken out of the earth, and brass is molten out of the stone. He setteth an end to darkness and searcheth out all perfection, the stones of darkness and the shadows of death. The flood breaketh out from the inhabitant. Even the waters forgotten of the foot, they are dried up and are gone away from men. As for the earth, out of it cometh bread, and under it turned up as it were fire. The stones of it are the place of sapphires, and hath dust of gold. There is a path which no fool knoweth, and which no vulture's eye hath not seen. The lion's whelps have not trodden it, nor the fierce lion passed by it. He put forth his hand upon the rock. He overturneth the mountains by the roots. He cutteth out the rivers among the rocks, and his eye seeth every precious thing. He bindeth the floods from the overflowing, and the thing that is hid bringeth forth to light. But where shall wisdom be found? And where is the place of understanding? Man knoweth not the price thereof, neither is it found on the land of the living. I was going into the fifth grade in a brand new school. I came to the school, and my mom and dad had moved us from Topeka, where I had gone to elementary, and that kind of fun period of life called the fifth grade found me in a brand new school. I remember the first week or so going, and you hate not having a place. You hate not fitting in. You hate not really connecting with anybody. And I remember trying to fit in. I tried to fit in. I tried hard to fit in. I tried too hard. I tried really, really, really hard. Anybody ever try too hard? I did that. That was me. It was fifth grade, and I wanted to fit in so bad. And I remember one of the young men, one of the boys that was in the school, came and brought his baseball card collection. And I had heard of good baseball card collections. I had never had one before. And I did have some baseball cards, though. I had gotten some baseball cards from for Christmas one year. And I remember there was a couple of other baseball cards. And there were some ones that weren't actually of baseball players. One of them was like back in the day, one of my cousins got a picture taken of himself in his baseball uniform, and it was in the shape of a baseball card. And so my mom just kind of put them all together and threw a rubber band around them. And they looked like a fifth grader had them. I mean, like all the ends were beat up on them, and I'd stuffed them in my pocket 1,000 times. And I had this small packet of baseball cards, and I saw the guys here. I mean, that's what they do here at this school. They have baseball cards. And so the next day I showed up and I had baseball cards. And so they got theirs out. And they were so impressed with my baseball cards that they put me on their shoulders and they ran me around the playground and they cheered and they shouted. It didn't go anything like that. Like, it was a bomb from the second I got them out of my pocket. Like, the moment I got them out of my pocket, I can still feel it in my gut. Put them back. Put them back. Put it back in your pocket. Put it back in your... Maybe they didn't see them. Put them back in your pocket. I remember, the hatred I had for myself having ever pulled them from my pocket. And as a fifth grade boy with a pocket of bent up baseball cards, I learned a very valuable lesson. And that is, don't ever show anybody your baseball... No, that's not the lesson. Actually, kind of payback, I ended up with more baseball cards than any of them did, and I win. That's what, no, wrong lesson as well. I did end up with a good baseball card collection eventually, but I did learn something, and that is that I didn't value the characteristics that they valued. The reason that I didn't fit in was because my values were different at that point. As a fifth grade little boy, I didn't value the things they valued. I had never thought that a card was collected for the price it would retain. I'd never had crossed my mind. I just had him because I liked the way he looked when he swung this bat. I liked the way that the picture and the field behind him. And I liked some of those cards had little foil pictures in them. And the longer I collected over the years, they just got more flashy and fun to look at. And I enjoyed looking at what it looked like. I enjoyed pulling them out and flipping through them. And I enjoyed just the feel of it. I did not know that you're actually not supposed to feel them, and you're not supposed to like touching them, because if you touch them, you get fingerprints on them, and instantly they're worthless. By the way, after 5 years of collecting them through high school, guess what? They're worthless. So I lost. I guess that's the whole story of it. I remember that through that time, I began to realize, no, I wasn't going to fit in with this group of boys, but I did actually enjoy baseball cards. I looked at their collections. They had these big books. How many of y'all ever had a big book of baseball cards? Some of you guys know what I'm talking about. That's right. And some of the ladies. All right. It's good to know. But they had these big books, right? And they had like just this plastic sheeting in it that was big enough to hold these cards. And you'd open a wrapper and you just automatically start putting them in the cards, because you don't want to get any, you don't want to knock the edges off of them, you don't want to put any creases in them. Some of y'all looking at me like I lost my mind. This is my way of introducing a message, is to alienate most of the congregation right off the beginning. But I kind of built this attraction to these cards. I enjoyed looking at them. I enjoyed looking at my friends' collections, and they liked looking at mine, and we went back and forth. But at the fifth grade, having never been exposed to those who did like baseball cards or liked them for a reason different than mine, I wasn't able to understand value. To me, they had a value because I liked the feel. I liked the look. I liked this thing or that thing. To them, they had an entirely different value. The value of what it could retain in its element, what you could hold together about it. If you didn't dog-ear the edges, if you didn't cut it or crease it, or if it didn't lose any of its glitter, then you would have this really special, valuable thing. So this message of value, this lesson of value that I had to take to heart, taught me that sometimes we don't know how to value what we think we value. That sometimes there are deeper ways of unpacking value. And something that is of little value to you one day may be of great value to you another day. Sadly, the reverse is the same. And that is that one day something may hold incredible value to you and sometime later hold little to no value to you. There are some who being in God's house holds great value to them. And over a year or two, we come to a day where it holds no value to them. You say, well, it's just horrible. Well, it's just a lesson in value. That's all it is. It says something bad about this person. I don't know that that's always the case. Sometimes it's just value changed. Bad, sure. It can be bad. Mom and dad start out with a desire to raise a family that honor and glorify God. They want to have lots of little kids that will please Jesus with the way they live their life. And over time, a job comes in or an opportunity gets in, or maybe there's exposure to some new thing for them to go do in some business venture or some sporting venture or some hobby or something comes along the way. And what once held great value now holds less and less and less value. We valued that marriage within the first month or two, even year or two. We valued that marriage over time. Husband and wife are tempted constantly to let it lose value. Here in this text, we find out why this is ranked among the wisdom literature. We find out that this is why we rank this as among those books that are called wisdom, right? Because it holds the characteristics of wisdom. It holds and elevates the idea of wisdom. What is happening here is that the books of wisdom, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, these are books of wisdom literature throughout Scripture. And the reason that they are is because they elevate through allegory. Okay, so it's an allegory. And if you look at your text, even in chapter 28, you're going to see an allegory. Job is not talking about gold. I mean, he is talking about gold. He's not talking about silver or iron, but he is talking about silver or iron. He uses the image. He uses the metaphor. He sets it in front of you and says, look, gold and silver. Gold and silver. And automatically, immediately, all of us can know that this is going to deal with something of great value. And so he uses this allegory. That is an indicator in Scripture that wisdom literature is close by, or poetry is close by. And you'll see the poetic elements in it. You can understand that this passage here is among some of the richest Jewish literature of all time. It's among some of the greatest ancient writings of all time, because here in this very simple pattern, he is writing out the value that you and I can place on something and place it there even if we've never really truly touched that thing. We may not ever put our fingers on it, and at the same time, we can value it greatly. You may never hold a block of gold in your hand, but you know that's valuable stuff. I've never held one in my hand. I've never had the whole bar in my hand, but boy, I tell you, I know right away that's of value. You can value something even if you've never even touched it. You find that this is an allegory, and among those, by the way, of wisdom literature, primarily because of what it does. The way it acts in chapter 28 is it acts as an ode, a song to wisdom. It acts as an ode to wisdom. It elevates wisdom highly. It lifts it to a proper place. And it sings, as if it were, about the beauty of wisdom. It's not even necessarily speaking about God's wisdom. However, because of its context of where it sits in all of the story before it and how it will fit into all the story beyond it, it is obvious that this is of God's wisdom. It's not speaking of man's wisdom because it is pushing even further than man can attain to. The idea is that this is God's wisdom, and God's wisdom deserves to be honored. It deserves to be elevated. It deserves to be glorified. It takes on the nature of like Proverbs 16. Proverbs 16 does something very similar to this. And what it does is it points out, it uses the image of wealth, right? It points out the image of wealth. And Proverbs is obviously a passage of wisdom literature. And it does the same thing. It elevates God's wisdom above that which we could even hold or attain. 16. In Proverbs 8, chapter 16, verse 8, he says, better is a little with righteousness than great revenues without right. It pursues even better than fame. It says, pursue wisdom, even if you have to give up fame to have it. In verse number 7 of Proverbs 16, he says, when a man's ways please the Lord, he maketh even his enemies to be at peace with him. He tells us to pursue after wisdom more than we pursue after pleasure. In chapter 16 of Proverbs, verse number 6, by mercy and truth, iniquity is purged, and the fear of the Lord, men depart from evil. It tells us to pursue after wisdom even more than we pursue after power and control. In verse number 5, he says, everyone that is of a proud heart is an abomination to the Lord. Though hand joined in hand, he shall not be unpunished. He is telling us here that wisdom in its full message is exactly as described. Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all thy getting, get understanding. See, this is just right in line with what Proverbs would teach us about wisdom. It is among those poetic passages of wisdom literature because it is pushing us the same way Proverbs does towards this principal thing called wisdom. He's saying to us, you're not going to be happy with money if you don't have wisdom. You're not going to be happy with power if you don't have wisdom. You're not going to be happy with relationships if you don't have wisdom. You're not going to be happy with anything you have if you miss the principal thing, the primary thing, if you miss out on wisdom. Can I tell you that the reason we lack wisdom today falls on the shoulder of one people? Do you know that? James tells us, if any man lack wisdom, let him ask of God. Do you know why our politicians today lack wisdom? Well, it's corrupt. It's just a corrupt system. Well, maybe, but they don't want wisdom. They want power, control, money. I can't tell you exactly which one. I've taken a stab or two at it. I've guessed once or twice what that politician was after. But I can tell you, the reason they lack wisdom is because they don't want wisdom. If you want wisdom and you don't have wisdom, there's only one cat to blame. In fact, if we're honest, if you don't have wisdom, even if you don't want it or not, it's your fault. I wish my kids would live with more wisdom. You want to know why your kids don't have wisdom? They don't want it. They don't want wisdom. They want to fit in. They want to look good. They want to have popularity. They want money. They want power. They want prestige. They want people to pat them on the back. They want to fit in. There's a million reasons why a young person has no wisdom. And all of those reasons are themselves. The reason you lack wisdom. You say, I don't know how to be the kind of dad I need to be. You want to know why you don't have the wisdom? Because maybe you're relying on you. If any man lack wisdom, let him ask of God. I believe it's telling. And I believe it's telling because sometimes we lack wisdom, yes, because we didn't ask for it. Sometimes we don't ask for it because we don't value wisdom. To the believer, wisdom is one of the principal things. Therefore, hope to get wisdom. Maybe you'll get wisdom. I hope you get wisdom. I think it'd be great if you had wisdom. And hopefully, if I can't have wisdom, at least everyone around me thinks I'm wise. And we fail to have true Bible wisdom, not because God doesn't make it accessible, not because somehow you don't fit the mold of the wise person, not because of the way you were brought up or the kind of money you make. The reason man lacks wisdom is because man does not value what God values. You say, how would I have wisdom? Let us start to learn how to value what God values. Learn to value what God values. Can I tell you that value is connected to what you will go through to have whatever it is you treasure? The value you place on something is directly, no. None of this gray line, none of this dotted line connection. It is a hard, bold, dark line. It is directly connected to what you will go through to have whatever you value. The reason we don't have strong marriages, and if your marriage isn't a strong one, I tell you today, it can be fixed, it can be adjusted, it can be helped. You're going to have to value your marriage. You're going to have to take it and place it at top. You're going to have to put it at the very top. You say, well, I have to lose time at work. Yeah, that's what I mean, is you're going to have to devalue something so that you might value something else. If you want a strong marriage, the work, by the way, it's not ever been hard. The problem with marriages today are not that they somehow got hard over the last 40 years, over the last 50 years. They didn't get hard. We put a lot of junk in their way. And so we have placed other priorities in the line, and we have not taken those priorities down so that we can put proper priorities up. The reason we're losing Christian young people is not because their parents have somewhere along the line dropped the ball in training. It's because, if I might be so bold as to say, that somewhere along the line, we've allowed a lot of other priorities to sneak in where our children belonged as the priority. They needed to be the priority, and we put something else in its place. We never brought their value down so that we might properly place our child's value where it belongs. Whatever you value will be ultimately demonstrated, directly connected to what you went through to attain it. If you value something, I'll know it. What is he saying? As our pastor, he's going to know stuff? No, I'm saying the neighbor next to you, sitting in the pew next to you, can know what you value. Your next door neighbor knows what you value. Your wife knows what you value. Your kids know what you value, because they simply have to look at what you're willing to endure to get what you value. You value something. How do I know? Well, look what you're willing to go through to get it. Oh man, we value our sports teams. How do you know it? Because some fools go sit out in the cold for it. I ain't doing that. You ain't talking to me to go sit in the cold. Hey, preacher, I got tickets for you. Well, most of them are going to happen on Sunday, and we got something going on Sundays, just in case you forget. So I have a different value there. So now I can't fit in there because I value something more than I value that. Well, preacher, don't worry. It's a night game. It's an evening game. Won't bother you. It's going to be on a Monday night. It's going to be on a Saturday. Okay, hold on. First thing, what's the temperature going to be? Right? Because preacher doesn't do any of this. Go sit in the 30s and he's not sitting in 16 degree weather. I ain't sitting in 16 degree weather to shoot a buck. I'm not sitting in 16 degree weather to watch a football game. I'm not sitting in 40 degree weather to go out there and shoot a buck or to go watch a football. I ain't doing it. You're not getting me to do it. That's dumb. And I don't mean dumb like dumb for me. I think y'all are dumb. No, I'm just kidding. I don't really believe that. It's just not in my value system. I value being warm far too much. No way. I'll watch that stuff from a restaurant. I ain't going to no football game. The truth is, we value something. You'll be able to see it. Somebody values the Chiefs. We know it because they're sitting out there and it's 10 degrees outside. Why? Why? Because they value it. It's not a bad thing. I'm just saying, let's just be honest about what our values are then. We can't say that we value money and at the same time value something that directly conflicts with it. We can't say we value our children if there is something on the other side that directly conflicts with our ability to invest in our children. You'll know someone who loves their spouse because of all they'll give up so that they might love their spouse. Because of everything they abandon so that they can have time, so they can have energy, so they can spend and invest. You'll know somebody who values their home because of what they'll give up that they might invest in that home. They've placed it as a priority. You see, we value, and we all know it by what you have to go through to get it. Look with me in the text. In chapter 28, it starts in verse number 1. Surely there is a vein for the silver, a place for gold where they find it. He's simply pointing out to us, if you want something, you can find it. If you're willing to dive in, you can have whatever it is you're after. You can have wisdom. You just have to go after it. You can have a good marriage. You just have to go after it. You can have godly children. You just have to go after it. You can have time before the Lord every day. You can take sweet fellowship with the Lord. You just have to do it. You have to go after it. You can have these things. It's just a matter of whether or not we're going to go after what it is we say we want. And this is his opening idea in verse number one. This is what Job is saying. Hey, do y'all not think we couldn't find the vein where silver is lying? You don't think we know where silver is at? This earth is filled with it. We could go after it at any point we want. You don't know that there's gold out there in them hills? You can go after the gold. Go for it. You can have it. You know where it's at. Surely there's a place for it. He's saying there's a place for it. There is a place where you can find earthly treasure. You can find success in your job. You can find success in the things that you claim you desire. Can I tell you, though, just because you know where it's at doesn't mean it deserves your attention. The reality is that some of us value some things and we bring those things close to our heart, and it's going to be easy to see what those things are because of how you pursue them. George Herbert, I believe it's Herbert, once said in a poem called Avarice, "Money, thou bane of bliss and source of woe, whence comest thou that art so fresh and fine? I know thy parentage is base and low. Man found thee poor and dirty in a mine. Surely thou didst so little contribute to the great kingdom which thou now hast got, that he was fain, when thou wert destitute, and dig thee out of thy dark cave and grot. Then, forcing thee by fire, he made thee bright. Nay, thou hast got the face of man, for we have with our stamp and seal transferred our right. Thou art the man, and man but dross to thee. Man calleth thee his wealth, who made thee rich, and while he digs thee out, falls into the ditch." The poem Avarice is juxtaposing man and gold. And how silly it is that man would trade himself for gold. But that's what he does. 1 minute at a time. 1 minute at a time, he gives up himself for gold. Thinks how silly it is. A man who has a great kingdom is king whether he has gold or not. But he goes and trades places with the gold he finds in the earth. He becomes poor so that the gold might be elevated to the kingdom. And this is what we do, isn't it? We do this in our own lives. We take that which is of little value, we give it the greatest value, we pursue after something of no value and sacrifice everything of real value until we can have that thing that doesn't really matter. All because we valued it. Value is directly connected to what you will go through to have it. Value is directly connected to where you will go to find it. In verse number 2, we find in this same text, "Iron is taken out of the earth, and brass is molten out of stone. He setteth an end to darkness and searcheth out all perfection, the stones of darkness and the shadow of death. The flood breaketh out of the inhabitant, even waters forgotten by the foot. They are dried up, they are gone away from man." It's amazing to me what kind of value we will place on something, even to the point where we actually let it teach us or tell us something that isn't true. Have you ever done that? You ever find somebody that buys something new and then they have to sell you on why they bought it? Anybody ever do that? My goodness. It reminds me of the story of the old man who came to his neighbor one day and he said, "Hey, I wanted you to know I got some new hearing aids. Pretty amazing, top of the line, best technology out there. I mean, they take sound, they put it into a digital form, and then they actually will input it into your ear, and at the same time, they'll reverberate against your bone, and they'll actually transfer the noise into your ear so you're actually hearing a fuller, richer sound. It's amazing. You ought to hear these things. It'll blow your mind." The neighbor was so taken back. He said, "Good night, that sounds wonderful. Well, what kind are they?" The man answered, "About 1230. So you have this value. Some of y'all is slow, right? Huh? Man, it was so good too. I laughed in my office for like 20 minutes by myself. I practiced that. That's good stuff. And some of y'all aren't going to get it until after dinner. Drives me nuts. You see, it is many, I don't even know where I'm going. I'm just going to dive right back into my notes and we'll just stop trying to repair that. I remind you the answer that Job is giving here to his terrorists, these men who have gathered around him to inflict on his soul this pain. I want to tell you this morning, man is searching for something. We're searching for something. Years ago, I preached a series called Strapped. And with it, in that series, we preached about the reality that we are always searching after something, something to fill our heart, something to make us feel complete. Many will try to fill this through their environment. They try to fill it through food. They try to fill it through excitement and things around them. They fill it through adrenaline, and they try to fill this need with sex. They try to fill it with experiences. They try to fill this desire in their heart with 1,000 things. And all the while, they say they have this addiction, or they say they have this desire, this thing that takes over their mind. And all these are simply crutches that kind of carry us along. They don't actually provide value, but they feel like value, so we hold that instead. We don't actually take on anything that makes us better, but we'll hold on to them as if they are making us better. And even in our text here, these three tormentors that are speaking to Job again and again and again, these three tormentors are coming to him with what they believe that makes them wise and better. And Eliphaz, this man, comes to Job a chapter after chapter, speaking to Job the way he does. He is this man who is tried to explain God through experiences. He is trying to help Job understand the events that he is in because of the experiences that he has gone through. Eliphaz is saying things like, I know from experience, and you should know that in your own past you've seen these things, Job. Can't you tell? Can't you see in your own? Can't you look at your life? Can't you look at the wild around you? Can't you see our culture? Can't you see this is the way it is, Job? And Job is as if he is supposed to step back and say, okay, I finally have meaning because of this experience. But sadly today, there are many who are trying to find satisfaction and happiness in experiences. People will go through history trying to find some great experience. They're trying to connect and belong to a larger group. They try to feel like they fit in with this big, large group. And if they belong to this club, or they belong to this partnership, or if they belong to this elite group, that makes them somebody special. It makes them fit in well. And they can feel as if they've arrived because they have this connection with some other thing. You look at services today like Ancestry.com or 23andMe.com. These are things that are simply made so that the police can find you. No, I'm just kidding. That's not the whole reason, but it is part of the reason, right? No? Okay, never mind. That's not right. Just know, you're never going to find your pastor's DNA on there or anywhere that the police can get my DNA from without a warrant. I'm not doing that. No way, man. You're going to have to come tackle me, take my DNA as you're dragging me out, because that's how they get you. Anyway, but you take these websites, and what they do, what are they trying to do? They're simply trying to provide the service of helping you connect. You get this report back, and the report back, and I know I just spoke facetiously about it. The truth is that it's actually a desire of somebody's heart. They want to know, well, what people group did I come from? What continent did I come from? What kind of heritage do I have? Why? Because there are many who are looking for connection, looking for belonging by this bigger group. And they want to fit in. If they fit into this bigger group, then they matter, and it really is important. And they matter because they fit into this greater group. Bildad was a traditionalist. He looked over the past generations and called on Job. Job, you can see how God's working. Job, you can look at where we come from. Job, look at our heritage. Look at our tradition. This is the same call on Job's heart. You can be satisfied because God has shown himself from the past. And Job is saying, no, man, this isn't it. This isn't what's happening. You guys think I've done wrong. You think that God is showing some justice in the heavens. I'm telling you that there is wisdom bigger than you have. And there's bigger than I have. And you look at Zophar, the religionist. Can I tell you that there are some today that come to religion and they go through the exercises of religion, not because they can find God in it, but because they can check the little box that tells them they're good. And they can check the little box that makes them feel like they've accomplished something. And as long as my religion's good, then I matter and I'm important and I'm actually can be satisfied. And can I tell you, religion has no ability to satisfy your heart. It has no ability to give you a connection with God. Going through the religious rite and ceremony does nothing to change you and your relationship with the Father. Yet we have those who are going through experiences today, going through trouble and going through trauma, going through pleasure, going through pain, going through happiness, going through wealth, and they're going from one thing to the other to try to find something that satisfies them. And I tell you tonight, I tell you this morning, that if you value God, he cannot be found in these things. The wisdom of God can't be found one experience to the other. It can't be found one relationship to the other. It can't be found one historical moment to the other. It is found when we turn to God himself. And only until the believer is willing to turn to God can he have the wisdom God has promised. You say, how do you know whether or not I value wisdom? Who are you turning to get it? If you're turning to the world, I'd say you value experience. If you're turning to the church, I'd say you value religion. If you're turning to God, I would say that's a person that wants wisdom. We can have the wisdom that truly satisfies the heart, but only if you want it, and only if you're willing to turn to where it is properly placed in the Father. Value is connected to who you find at its discovery. Read verse 9 with me, would you? He putteth forth his hand upon the rock. He overturneth the mountains by the roots, cutteth out the rivers among the rocks. His eye seeth every precious thing. He bindeth the floods from overflowing. The thing that is hid bringeth he forth to light. But where shall wisdom be found? And where is the place of understanding? Man knoweth not the price. He's saying man doesn't know how to value wisdom. Man doesn't know how to value wisdom. Neither is it found in the land of the living. Can I tell you this morning? Wisdom is directly connected to who you find when you found it. Values are shown and demonstrated by what you find at its source. You read the text here, and from verse number 9 to verse number 11, you hear the words of Job as he says, you know what, God could put his hand into the earth, and he could turn the whole mountain over with his fist. He'd just grab it by the roots. I love the idea of a mountain having roots. He said that God could reach into the mountain and pull it out by its roots. God has that ability. God has the ability. He goes through about three verses here. And you look who he talks about in verse number 9. He. Verse 10, he. Verse 11, he. Verse 12, he. Through all of this experience, even sitting in pain and boils as his flesh lays exposed to the elements, as he is hurting and everything about him is falling apart. His bones ache, his head hurts constantly. He can't close his eyes and sleep won't bring peace because he wakes up with these night terrors. And all the while, his body is trying to die. He says, man can't understand wisdom. And God has it at the source. Man cannot provide you wisdom, but all you have to do is go to the hand of God, and it's as if God could provide it from his very self. Does this sound like a man who's angry at God? Does this sound like a man who's bitter at God? Job, even through all the pain and all the loss and all the anguish and all the hurt, through all the nightmares, through every experience he's had to this point, these friends, one after the other, speaking against his relationship with God the Father. And at its core, in chapter 28, we find Job still enamored with God. You want to know who Job is finding through this experience? He's saying, wisdom doesn't lie with man. Oh, guys, hold on. I hear you talking, but man can't find wisdom. I'm so sick of people going into self-discovery mode. I'm so tired of it. I gotta discover myself. Like there's something to be found there? You've lived with yourself for 18 years. Most of those years, somebody else was picking up after you and wiping your nose and making sure that you were on the school bus on time. You were smart enough to set an alarm clock, and you got to discover who that dummy is? Come on. I was 19 years old. My dad was still calling me dumb kid. You want to know why? Because I was a dumb kid. It wasn't anything to discover about myself. That's pride. Job says, listen to me. I am not imagining that I have something here. Because wisdom can't be found in me. And wisdom can't be found in you three fools. And wisdom can't be found even among the land of the living. Wisdom is not found in man. Job, God is quite literally killing you. I know, but he's got wisdom. And if we're going to place him where he properly belongs, God's up here, man's down here. Job didn't need to go through self-discovery. Job was not going through a process of reestablishing self-esteem. Job was coming to the place where no matter what came his way, I will trust in the one who provides wisdom. Can I tell you this morning, if you go after wisdom, please do not expect that you're going to go on a journey of self-discovery. Please know, to find wisdom, it's less of you, more of him. To find real lasting wisdom in your marriage, it's not more of the two of you, it's more of the Father. To find the ability to raise godly children, it's not more of mom and dad, it's more of God the Father. And I tell you this morning that when you start discovering yourself, oh, I've just learned some wonderful things about myself, then get on your knees before a holy God and beg him to stop whatever you're doing. And start discovering the Father. Whatever you value, we'll know it because you want it. Whatever you value, you'll know it because you're willing to sacrifice for it. More importantly, whatever you value, you'll know because either you're learning more about yourself and placing yourself up high, or you're learning more about him, in which case we properly bring man right to where he belongs.